Welcome one and all to another episode of The Damage Report with me, John Iadarola, and joining us for the first time ever on the show, our neighbor from the north, a man who is both rational and national, David Dole, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. I heard that you won an award, so I wanted to make sure I got in on that and and part of the next one. So it's good to be on the show.
Thank you. Well, you managed to come on for the first time before I actually accept the award. So now you have claim to it as anyone. No, it's just a Webby, but we do appreciate it. So for you, those of you in the audience who voted for us so many times, we really appreciate it. It was both good to get the award in its own right and great to beat those bastards from Insider. No, I'm kidding. We like a lot of people from Insider, but anyway, I apparently am going to be going to the Webbies in New York to accept it. And we still haven't figured out our 5-word acceptance speech. Apparently you can't use swears. So we're still working on that. But anyway, thank you everyone again for voting. And David, thank you for being here. I know that you obviously do your own show. And so you're a busy man. So we appreciate it.
No problem. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. And by the way, I'm going to preview what we'll be talking about in the show and everything. But for people who might not be familiar with you from your work or your appearances on the network, can you tell people a little bit about what you tend to cover, what angle you tend to come at the news from? How did you get into this whole thing?
Yeah, so I started about 5 years ago during Bernie's first run for president in 2016. And before I began the show, I actually was a Green Party candidate in Canada. And because of I was inspired by him, inspired by others that were at the time putting out a really progressive message centering human rights, caring about others. I wanted to find a place to kind of get that message out there. So I launched the YouTube channel, and that's what it's about. I care about equality, human rights, workers' rights, and that's the perspective that I bring.
Awesome. That's cool. And a great throwback to a great period. The progressive yes. Movement 2016.
All downhill since then. So
yeah. No, I mean, look, we've had some good victories, but last night wasn't one of them. So we will be talking about that in just a moment, dear viewers. And along the way, we're gonna be talking about a lot of other things as well, including some of the reactions to what's going on the SCOTUS, the future of Roe v. Wade, and you know, like all of your rights and everything. So we'll be getting into that. What else? Oh, Biden and his team have a strategy that they think is going to help them in the midterms. We're going to debate whether we think that'll work or not. And eventually, another comedian attacked on stage, this time Dave Chappelle. So it's become a spree, and we'll be giving our opinions on that as we go as well. Along the way, if you're on a platform that allows for liking or sharing, that'd be great. So the people know that we're live, they get their notifications, and everything is good. And if you want to send us tweets, comments, super chats, anything like that, Dave and I will respond as we go. But with all that said, David, do you want to jump into some news?
Sounds good.
Awesome. We're going to start off on a positive note, perhaps an inspiring note with this.
This eternity ain't going nowhere. But that's all right, Pastor Early. They can't contain this black girl magic. Cause what I am going to do is I'm gonna take this magic all over this country and shake it that way.
So that is, of course, Nina Turner with what is being called, I think, indisputably the best concession speech ever. And you know, taking a night that had been very rough in terms of the politics, the results of a couple elections involving progressives that, you know, it left a lot of progressives, I think, feeling pretty depressed. And then she really turned it around. And I want to give you just a little bit more of what she had to say. Let's take a look.
But what Sister Turner is going to do is to continue taking my skills nation, and I'm gonna see some folks in 2024. Hello? Stay tuned. This is what y'all asked for. My mama used to say, sometimes you're gonna get what you asked for. And that corporate money coming up in here this way to suppress and malign the voices of working class people in this district, in this nation, and in this world. Nothing yet. They gonna get what they asked for.
I'm sure the vibe in Chantel Brown's party was just as fired up, excited about all that she would try her damnedest to accomplish now that she was going to be sent back to Congress. But anyway, David, obviously, so yeah, you've got that hinting at a presidential run in 2024, the most open hint of it that I've seen from her. Of course, coming in a night where she did lose, unfortunately. What do you think?
Yeah, so I mean, it's been an incredibly depressing week. And I was actually watching your coverage last night when she was giving that speech, and it was like this burst of energy that I needed. It was, I've never seen somebody so energized after losing. I mean, ultimately, she lost, and unfortunately, she lost big. A lot of money was spent against her, but she was out there with a hopeful message and continuing the fight. And when you see somebody who's in the worst place they can be like that after a loss, still have that kind of energy, I think that shows other people that, you know, regardless of how you're feeling right now, there you have to have hope. You have to keep fighting, because otherwise, if you don't do that, what is there? So yeah, it was amazing to see that. And I'm looking forward to seeing what she plans to do in 2024.
Yeah, definitely. You know, obviously along the way, we still have more primaries in this cycle, including really important primaries featuring progressive candidates, Jessica Cisneros and others. We have to get through those midterms. We're still, you know, we're what, at least a year and a half until people start announcing for the presidential campaign. There's a lot to do, but I agree. I was feeling the same thing. Like even inside of the concession speech, I went into it feeling just like, God, not again. Like I've covered a lot of primaries on a lot of specials, and there have been some great ones. I remember covering AOC's victory and all that, but there have been a lot of depressing ones as well. And she did do a great job at really turning it around, acknowledging, of course, that as you can see in this, she's going to end up have gotten about a little bit more than one third of the vote. You know, a lot of money was spent on this race. It really was. And Chantel Brown can come out of it saying, this is a hard fought victory. I'm going to continue to show up for you. What do you mean continue? What like in the time that you've been in office, what are your achievements? What are your accomplishments? Or even what have you attempted to do? I understand you can't always do exactly what you want to do, especially as a new person to the House. But where were you showing up? Like, the big donors showed up for you in this race to dump millions of dollars. For instance, the Democratic majority for Israel's Political Action Committee spent more than $1 million on a House race in Ohio. The Democratic majority for Israel is really invested in this House race in Ohio. Probably, if I had to guess, because they care so much about what happens to the working class in Ohio. David, if I had to guess, I think that's why they were so invested.
Yeah, but John, she's part of the Progressive Caucus. I mean, she's obviously progressive, right? Like that's, isn't that the signifier? Oh yeah, she's also part of the New Dem Coalition, the Business Friendly mm-hmm. Caucus. Interesting how that works. How can you be, this is what is so amazing about this race or you know, Chantel Brown and others like her. How can you be a part of both of these groups? Like what, at that point, what's the point of these caucuses? Like mm-hmm. if you can be part of two diametrically opposed groups within the party, then what's the point of having them? And by the way, she joined the Progressive Caucus the day before Nina announced her rematch. She knew that was coming. She was already a part of the New Dem Coalition back in December. She only joined the Progressive Caucus later as a way to say, hey, look, I'm also progressive. Yeah, I support Medicare for all, even though I'm not going to fight for it at all. But I support all these things, despite all the money coming in, big oil, big pharma, Republican money coming in against to fight Nina because they're so afraid of her. I mean, it shows you how they realize how powerful she would have been in Congress. That's yeah. why they spent this amount of money, because she is a fighter and they know that. And they also should realize now that she's not going away.
Yeah, 100%. And I certainly hope not. Yeah, look, they can call their groups, their caucuses, whatever they want in the same way that North Korea can call itself a Democratic People's Republic if they want to. It turns out you can just say things and there really aren't any consequences. What we need, of course, is an actual progressive caucus. Let's work towards that. And yeah, it's just, look, we need a leader. We need someone to have hope in. I know that, like, you know, Bernie's still indicating that he might run in the next race. I think a lot of the left is greeting that with a little bit of mixed feelings about his age and, you know, the two past runs and everything. And there's some others, you know, other progressives who are good. But of course, as we talked about at length last night, a lot of them were either not involved at all in Nina's race or barely involved at the last moment. And look, it's just, this is a difficult fight in a lot of different ways. It was difficult back in 2016, and I would argue that we only face more obstacles, more opposition, more money, more defections from the left, people who are chasing right-wing views and money and everything. And so it's even harder now. We need some good victories. We need some leaders, I think. And at the very least, Nina, in announcing that she's likely to run in 2024, I think is providing some of that, David.
Yeah, and you know, I think a lot of the energy as well is it has to, and it's going to come from the working class, from organizing, from unions, seeing victories like the one with the Amazon warehouse, like all the Starbucks union victories. That is what's going to add or I think generate a lot of the energy needed going forward into the future. Electoral politics, you know, is important. Don't get me wrong, it's of course important. But you're not going to have any success there unless you have some real working class organizing from the ground up pushing for that success. So we have to see more of that going forward. I think that's what's going to lead to a lot of, you know, victories in the future. And ultimately, look, younger generations are more aware, are the ones being hit by a lot of this garbage when it comes to the massive and growing gap between the rich and the poor. The insane, I mean, the fact that wages are so incredibly low, people are struggling, healthcare is incredibly expensive in America. People are not taking it anymore. And the more that these younger generations, you know, get involved and start voting and get organizing, that's going to affect, I think, a potential, you know, a quicker shift that I think a lot of people are maybe expecting. Simply yeah. because I want, you know, at some point it's going to make, you know, we're going to turn the corner and they're going to be the majority, and you know, we're going to be the majority, the millennials, Gen Z, and we're going to be taking over and changing how all of this operates.
I certainly hope so. Here in the United States, what candidates need to have done in terms of their experience, what they need to say, the things that would normally disqualify them, everything's topsy-turvy. We've entered the land of the kooks. And so I thought, we've got David on. I am assuming that things haven't devolved quite so far in Canada when it comes to what you can get away with. But I wanted to give people updates on last night's primaries, some of the candidates who won despite things that should be immediately disqualifying. And one who didn't. There's a bit of good news buried here. We're going to start though with Max Miller. Now, Max Miller won his primary handily, 71.8% of the vote. Apparently, Republicans, they're big fans of him, despite the fact that he, as so many Republicans these days are, is facing allegations of domestic abuse. Stephanie Grisham, by the way, like at one point, a beloved part of the right is the one making the accusations, David. But it doesn't seem to have bothered people, 72%. And that might be an early warning sign, as I talked about last night on our coverage, that there's a ton of other, I'm blanking now on candidate Walker, former football player, Herschel Walker. And others. And so it's not looking like domestic abuse and things like that are gonna be an issue for Republican voters. What do you think?
No, at this point, the only thing that's going to hurt Republican candidates is if they are wonderful people and actually care about others. I mean, that's all, like if it comes out that, oh, this person actually, they care for people. They help, somebody was wounded and they brought them in. Somebody was homeless and they gave them food. Oh, we can't have this guy, gotta have somebody else. Like it is absolutely disgusting to see what it's come to, and that what is valued in the Republican Party is hatred. Is your willingness to hate others simply for who they are, that is what is valued. Your apparent now abuse of others, that's also valued, or they don't care about that at all. As long as you are saying the right things in terms of how they view politics, just you know, through the lens of the culture war, as long as you are for white people and against everybody else, then you are valued in the party. And it is absolutely disgusting.
Exactly, yeah. Max Miller would like beat Jesus in a landslide in one of these Republican primaries. Now, another candidate who won, candidate who apparently went to DC for the insurrection, lied about it, and then it turned out we realized he was lying when the photo evidence of him at the actual insurrection came out. He's a guy who's worn a QAnon shirt, he's used QAnon catchphrases in his social media and everything, so that's fun and exciting. But there was one candidate who we talked about a while back on the show, thankfully didn't win. So this is Robert R.J. Regan, who lost to Democrat Carol Glanville. This is the 74th Michigan House District. And if you don't recall Robert R.J. Regan, he's a guy that at one point said, you know, that's kind of like having three daughters. And I tell my daughters, well, if rape is inevitable, you should just lie back and enjoy it. That's not how we roll. That's not how I won this election. He later attempted to walk back the comments, saying, you would never say something like that to a woman. I have three daughters, and I would never say that if rape is inevitable, you should just lie back and enjoy it. I mean, that's horrible. Nobody agrees with that. Good, you did say it though. And interestingly, I didn't even know this at the time that we did that story initially. 2 years prior to those remarks, which happened earlier this year, one of his daughters, Stephanie, encouraged voters not to elect her father, saying, if you're in Michigan and 18 plus, please, for the love of God, do not vote for my dad for state rep. Tell everyone. So yeah, I think that the thing about the daughters is probably understandably a sore spot because he's a massive weirdo and creep.
Yeah, if your kids are saying don't vote for you, if your relatives are saying, yeah, this guy is terrible. Yeah, they know him best.
Yeah.
Listen. So, you know, I guess, you know, there's a bar somewhere, maybe.
Exactly. At least he lost. So maybe at the state level, we can still get some sanity. In any event, we're going to take our first break because coming up on the other side, we're going to dive into the ongoing SCOTUS Roe v. Wade thing. And there's a lot of stuff that we have to get to in that. So don't go anywhere. We are just getting started. Okay, let's jump into how some are responding to what the SCOTUS is up to, starting with this video.
I'm angry and upset. Angry and upset and determined. The United States Congress can keep Roe versus Wade the law of the land. They just need to do it.
I've never seen you so angry. You seem to be.
This is what the Republicans have been working toward this day for decades. They have been out there plotting, carefully cultivating these Supreme Court justices so they could have a majority on the bench who would accomplish something that the majority of Americans do not want. 69% of people across this country, red states and blue states, old people and young people want Roe versus Wade to maintain as the law of the land.
The womb,
we need to do
no,
it. And we have a right. Extremists, we've heard enough from the extremists. And we're tired of it.
Okay, so fun. People shouting over that. But you saw there Elizabeth Warren. Now, I'm always very suspicious when I see politicians getting really emotional. But I think I can probably buy it in this case. Everything that she said about the polls and about the Republican strategy has been true. And even if some of them would have to sort of work themselves up and feign anger, I kind of want it, David, because I feel like the Democratic response from politicians has still been pretty muted. It's a few like Kyrsten Sinema putting out a statement that like now more than ever, we need the filibuster to protect women's rights and all that. There's no fire on their side, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's good to see this kind of energy. As you were saying, a lot of times this is sort of like faked and that kind of thing. I do think Elizabeth Warren is legitimately angry about this. She's obviously a supporter of women's rights, has been for a while. Even if we have her criticisms of her and her strategy sometimes, she obviously cares about this issue. So, you know, we need to see this from all of them, right? Like that nothing is going to get done here. Like the passion is one thing. It's another thing to actually eliminate the filibuster and codify abortion rights into law. So, you know, until that happens, until some actual steps taken to try and do that, all of this ultimately means nothing. Like it's good to see it. I'm glad that energy is there, but they have to be able to challenge that energy or channel that energy into some actual progress. And, you know, they're in power. They're the ones to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And they were in power before this decision. As we've been cruising month by month, knowing that the Supreme Court is considering multiple reproductive rights focused challenges, knowing that the conservatives have a supermajority on the Supreme Court, and the Democrats just waited and waited and waited. But don't worry, everyone. She's not the only person worked up. Democrats have a plan. And it's, as we predicted yesterday, they're looking to use this to salvage the midterms. So they're thinking like, hey, maybe this will help us in the next election. Oh, good, because then we'll have Democratic control and surely then they'll do something. They already control the presidency, the Senate and the House. And now it's supposed to be a thing that gets people fired up and out to vote. It's the most predictable thing in the world. And by the way, people should be fired up and they should vote, but that's on them. That's a ripple effect. That's a consequence. You're in power. You're supposed to be the leaders. You're supposed to be actually doing something. You're supposed to be inspiring them to come out and to vote. It shouldn't just be a continual cycle of people being horrified at the assaults against them from the right every 2 years. And then you guys just sit on the sidelines and maybe benefit briefly from it. So anyway, like I'm not surprised, obviously, David, that they're looking to this as a potential thing that's gonna help them out. But that feels to me like passing the buck, that they're just gonna wait months now until November and not fight against this thing. What do you think?
Yeah, it's like saying turn off the lights or buy an electric car to fight climate change. Like, you, individual action can only take you so far, and you have to actually, when it comes to voting, you have to give people a reason to come out and vote. Like, I agree with you. I'm going to, of course, encourage people to vote, as you know, people that have a platform should. But I'm not going to blame people who are not, you know, watching my show, or people that just don't feel energized to vote because they vote and nothing really changes. You have Democrats with Congress, with the White House. They have power now. And yes, you can say, oh, but Manchin, oh, but Sinema. Sure, but at least fight, do something. Biden can do, you know, can actually accomplish things through executive order that he's not willing to do right now. Yeah. And so this shows people, if you actually show some fight, people are gonna be, you know, cognizant of that. And they're gonna be aware and be, and at that point, actually be more willing to vote for you, because they see, oh, okay, we see you trying to fight, we see you doing whatever you can, but you know, you lack a couple numbers here, so we'll help you out. But mm-hmm. if you're not even trying to fight and you're just saying again, oh, go vote, that's gonna, you know, solve the problem, then you're just gonna keep losing and yeah. you're never gonna actually accomplish anything.
100%. And what have they done to try to get Manchin and Sinema on board? And look, you might be watching this and think, well, there's nothing they can do that'll work. Okay, what exactly is the risk in trying at this point? Let's say you went nuclear and you literally booted them out of the party or whatever. No, you can't do that. Then you won't have the majority. What good is the majority right now? And how long are you going to have it? You're definitely going to lose the majority in a few months. You're not using it. I won't swear. You're not really using it these days anyway. So what is the cost to at least sending a message to others who look to someday be Manchin or Sinema? They should be terrified of that as a political strategy. You've given them no reason whatsoever to be terrified. Now, that is the response of some on the Democratic side. There's a little bit of righteous anger, and then there is political opportunism. On the right, Axios received some Senate Republican abortion talking points. So how they want to message about this, and I'd like to highlight a few parts of that. The first is, they suggest be the compassionate consensus builder on abortion policy. While people have many different views on abortion policy, Americans are compassionate people who want to welcome every new baby into the world. So be compassionate, welcome those babies into the world, even if the way that you get them is by chaining a woman to a hospital bed and forcing her to give birth to the child of the guy who raped her. That's compassionate, that's what I always say. The message doesn't seem to have been received by all Republicans though, because this morning I woke up to a Matt Gaetz tweet that said, how many of the women rallying against overturning Roe are overeducated, underloved millennials who sadly return from protest to a lonely microwave dinner with their cats and no Bumble matches? So this is sort of literally insult being added to injury, David. Not a lot of consensus building coming from Matt Gaetz.
Yeah, that's just Twitter messaging. I mean, these people complain about, you know, the Twitter people. They're the ones that are putting messages like that out there simply for the clout. That's what that's for. And look, if this was about babies, then there'd be universal healthcare, or they'd be fighting for it, or there'd be universal pre-K or universal parental leave. Like, there's none of that. This is not about babies, if this is about life, then they would be forcing you to give your kidney up to save somebody else, or forcing you to give blood. They aren't doing that.
No.
So how is this about life? It's simply about controlling people's bodies. That's it. And it works for, you know, I guess their diehard base, even though the majority of people do not support it. They want abortion rights, and it's been that way forever. Yet they use this as a major wedge issue and put out garbage like that tweet to try and galvanize people into supporting them. It's disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, nobody like on the left or even in the center is gonna give a damn about what Matt Gaetz thinks. His insults aren't gonna convince them. That is actually targeted at the right, and it's designed to beat conservative women into submission. No one is ever gonna love you, no one is ever gonna marry you, no one is ever gonna wanna sleep with you unless you accept the never-ending onslaught of the right against you, stripping away your rights, mocking you to your face, implying that the only role you should ever have in society, in life, is being some sort of supplicant to whichever man decides to bring you into his life. That's what they're saying. And unfortunately for a lot of conservative women, it's a message that's been received. And at least insofar as those who want to be members of right-wing media or politicians, they've accepted this bargain. It was even before the thing was leaked, Marjorie Greene was giving some speech about how women don't need any economic support. There shouldn't be child support or anything like that, because that convinces women that they're married to the government and women need to be married to men. So they should be desperate and thrown to the wolves so that they will finally do the only thing that they're qualified to do, which is land a man. That was before SCOTUS, and that was one of the most popular female Republicans in this country.
It's so gross. And you know, I wonder how they are able to win with this kind of message that really is appealing to a minority. But here's how they win: that tiny minority, or that 30% that supports this, they come out to vote. This galvanizes them enough. Like, they care enough about these cultural issues that they will vote simply on this. Whereas this is again showing what Democrats need to do. They need to reach out to people that don't normally vote. And you do that by actually accomplishing something, helping people while you are in power. And Biden, through executive order, can do that right now in a variety of ways. And he's not even trying to do that or trying to fight Manchin or send him to do anything. So this ultimately, yes, of course, Republicans are disgusting, they're gross, and we can point that out. But we also have to understand Democrats, by not trying to get out those typical non-voters, are also at fault here for not defeating this.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Dems, they understand that on some level. That's why occasionally when they run for president, they imply that they're gonna do something. They know that that's the thing that galvanizes the base. They just don't actually make good on it. They make the promises and then they move on. And that's been a cycle that we've seen for some time.
Talking about the same conversation that happened 40 years ago, today's Democrats are advocating in many cases for the rights to have an abortion beyond the birth of the child. And most Americans would say that's not something that sits well with me. And so for Democrats to go out on the campaign trail, if they want to put all their eggs in this basket and have this conversation about a much more aggressive, to have a much more aggressive conversation about this issue, I think that will be at their own political peril, because it is so far out of step with where most Americans feel on this very sensitive issue.
But to Cassie's point, I don't know of any serious leading Democrat, any real elected Democrat that supports abortion for a baby already delivered. That is extreme. That's murder in this country. And no Democrat supports that. I support fundamental limits on abortion in terms
of Virginia.
Which governor supports actual murder of a child delivered?
Former governor of Virginia. That was a big scandal you guys tried to push under the rug.
Which governor?
But so address
Ralph Northam. That's not true. That's not true.
Okay. Well, there's a radio interview that says
that's actual murder, Cassie. But listen.
Okay, so I don't know what she's referring to there. Let's say that we accept everything that we just said and assume that she's acting in good faith, which is a crazy thing to do, but we're gonna do it for the sake of this, just as fun. She doesn't even remember the name of that guy. So one could make the argument that he's hardly a leader in the Democratic Party. And honestly, that former Biden surrogate who was like, no leading Democrat supports that. You could go a little bit further. It's not just that not leading elected Democrats support that. Who supports that? I've talked about abortion a lot on this show. Don't recall ever advocating for, like, I don't know, maybe as like at the 1 year birthday, you get a redo. You know, I don't remember that. David, to be fair, I haven't seen every video that you've put out. Have you advocated for post-birth abortion? I'm pretty sure you haven't, but feel free to correct the record.
No, I have not. I mean, it's not murder until what, like age two? Like, it's just abortion until age two? Like, what is does she even realize what she's saying? Because I don't think she does. Like, this really sounds like somebody who just, you know, is all engaged in complete right-wing lunatic media. Heard some, some interview that was taken out of context or something that was said that she construed differently. And she thinks abortion after birth, like, is a thing that first of all exists. And then second of all, that anybody actually supports or has discussed supporting. Like, how can anybody be this stupid? It is just, seeing this kind of garbage amazes me. And guess who the ones that actually are pro-murder? If you are anti-choice, you are forcing women to have unsafe abortions and more women will die. That is a fact. So they are anti-women and pro-death. That is actual messaging that Democrats can use and would be factual. That would be actual fighting. I would love to see Democrats actually go out there and say that, because that is true. So there is no, you know, abortion after birth, but there is pro-death, anti-women conservatives. They're the ones in support of getting rid of a woman's right to choose.
Exactly. Yeah, and even that lunatic who apparently wants every fetus to be born. Then she immediately turns it back on them. She doesn't give a damn what happens to them. If they're, you know, drinking like lead tainted water and stuff like that, if they have no educational prospects, if they're going to be born into a world that's going to be wrecked by climate change, screw them. But at least they were born. That's where the obligation really ends. And she's just making it up. This is what basically all Republican politics is really need to get people worked up. So something about babies, I guess. I don't know. They're aborting them or they're eating them or they're having sex with them. I don't know what'll work, what'll make you love me. And honestly, you said that she doesn't know what she's talking about and she's stupid, and that's true. But as I always say, you only ever in this industry are as smart as you need to be. Like I say, Charlie Kirk gets tons of retweets. He's never had an actual thought in his life, but why would he? He already gets the retweets. She's already going on Fox News. I'm not being brought onto major news networks, so she doesn't need to be any smarter or funnier or more compassionate or more talented or anything. That's just the way that it works, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is really easy to be a conservative in my country as well, but also in your country, because it involves no thinking whatsoever. We could decide today, you know what? We want to make a ton of money. Well, this is why I left the left, because they're eating babies, and we will end up on Fox News. Like it's that easy, because there's no, you don't have to think at all. As long as you say the right things, you use the right buzzwords and you know the right people, you will make a lot of money and be successful just pushing out garbage to millions of people.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Tucker will help you get your Substack, get some more subscriptions. He'll be happy to briefly. They will wring from you whatever lingering credibility you have from having formerly been on the left, and then that'll be it. And you'll get money. You'll have a nice house and you'll have helped really evil people destroy this country, but that's a bargain that some people make. In any event, I want to jump to one more video, one more take on this. Apologies in advance to the audience, but take a look.
Exactly if that's true, because it was certainly something that they're working on. It would imagine, I don't think anyone made it up. It sounded like him. He's a great man, by the way. He's a tremendous guy. But as a justice, he's just fantastic. And you have some great ones up there now, but we have to find out what that means. And is somebody going to do something about it? Are they going to try and change it? Is it real? Nobody really knows, and they don't know who leaked it. I will say the leak was a terrible thing. You're just not used to that for the Supreme Court. We see it so much leaking in our world, in your world, in my world. And although not so much now, it's very interesting. You know, you try and cover those leaks, but you've never seen it, or they've rarely seen it in the Supreme Court. It was very shocking, I think.
And look, he goes on to say that some will blame him for this and some will give him the credit. And that makes sense. He chose three of the religious zealots that are amongst the conservative supermajority and did this. And this is what he said he would do. He chose people who would go before the Senate and lie about what they were going to do. But this was always the goal, despite obviously we don't need to remind the audience that Donald Trump doesn't care about abortion. He doesn't have an issue with it. Like you think that he would be opposed to it in his own life or whatever? Like it's ridiculous, David. But he gave them what they wanted. They've elected other Republican presidents before who haven't necessarily put onto the Supreme Court people who are dead set on killing Roe v. Wade. But Trump gave them that. He made good on that promise.
Yeah, he delivered exactly why he was there. I mean, that's why Republican lawmakers ended up supporting him. Like, as long as this guy's going to be our puppet and we're going to be the exact same party we always were, sure, we'll get a little worse in terms of, you know, the rhetoric, I guess, how we were perceived publicly. But ultimately, they got their agenda through. That was their agenda before Trump even came along. So they accomplished that. And now look how this whole twist around with, oh, it's about the leaking. So much leaking going on. I can't believe this got leaked. Really? That's the takeaway here? Not that the rights of millions are about to be removed, but that somebody leaked this, which, by the way, may have been a conservative. Because what this ends up doing is it makes it tougher for those justices to that now change their position on this because it is out publicly. So, you know, this assumption here from all these conservatives that it must be some far woke leftist that did this, as Megyn Kelly pointed out. Mm-hmm. That's not even possibly true. Like, we don't know who leaked it, but ultimately I don't care. Like, what actually matters here is how this is going to impact society.
Yeah, no, nobody actually cares. Maybe the justices, I'm not even sure that they care, because again, they have the power. They don't have to change. It's the weird thing about working for a place like Fox. You never know what you're gonna have to pretend to care about, because the actual narratives that you're spinning aren't chosen by you. They're not drawn from your value system or your ideology. You just are handed things to say that you care about. Now it's, oh, we care about the leak. We're gonna do hours of, God, it would be so boring as a job to have to do stuff like that. But anyway, I guess the millions of dollars make it worth it.
We've always managed to overcome the obstacles, the challenges. The resiliency of the company is directly related to the leadership that you have provided. But the challenges right now are real and they're in front of us. And the challenges are multiple. The pandemic, a post-pandemic customer, the relationship we have with our customers, competitive threats, and now a new outside force that's trying desperately to disrupt our company. Well, I believe in Starbucks more than ever because I believe in all of you. My faith and confidence in the future of Starbucks is based on my faith and confidence in you, not some outside force that's going to dictate or disrupt what we are and who we are and what we do.
So that right there is, of course, the CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, saying that he has faith in the group of managers that he's talking to, to stop what is happening at Starbucks, which is an incredibly successful, almost impossible to imagine, quick number of stores being flipped to union supporting. And he says it's an outside force. They're employees. They're employees in many cases, have worked there for a very long time. We've interviewed some of them here on the program. And he doesn't want the unionization pushed. So he's fought against that in a number of different ways. There's been tactics in the New York area where they're like flooding stores with managers to intimidate the workers there. They do have a new plan though, and it is, sounds at least on the surface, pretty good. They're gonna be hiking wages and doubling trainees for new training for new employees. They said it's gonna be immediate nationwide pay increases with better sick time benefits, and for the first time, the option for customers to tip with their credit cards coming this fall. I find it inconceivable that you couldn't do that up until now, but I don't really go to Starbucks. So this sounds pretty good, David. Higher pay, more sick time. Little tiny caveat on it though, and that is that they will not be offering the enhanced benefits to workers at the roughly 50 company-owned cafes that have already voted to unionize. Such changes at unionized stores would have to come through bargaining. So they are trying to co-opt the movement, or at least the workers who might become a part of the movement naturally, by saying, don't go with this group that will, for the rest of your career at Starbucks, be fighting for your interests. Take this little raise now. Okay, it's pretty diabolical. What do you think?
It's funny because they're trying to stop this movement, but at the same time, they are proving the benefit of unions and how they benefit everyone. Because even if you are not in a union, and this isn't about Starbucks, this is, you know, regardless of company, the more that unions exist, the higher wages and benefits are, because those non-unionized workplaces now have to compete with the unionized workplaces. And you're seeing a microcosm example of that right here at Starbucks. They realize to compete with this union effort, they have to actually raise pay, offer more benefits, and maybe listen to their partners, they call them, their workers. So this is just, you know, an attempt to stop this, but ultimately these unions can organize and fight for these same benefits, the same pay. I mean, the scare tactics here, I don't think are going to work. It's important, you know, regardless of pay, benefits, all that, it's important for workers to be able to have their own voice, to have, you know, an organized fight on their side against their ownership, against the capital owners. I mean, that's ultimately how we generate power, how we have power, how we fight for better things, you know, higher wages, benefits. So it's important to have this, you know, regardless of what Starbucks is offering non-unionized employees. But even still, I mean, as I said, I think it's showing the benefit of this fight overall. It's helping everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, it is just the most recent demonstration that these sorts of efforts, when they start to get successful and they start to get coverage, can have benefits for people outside of just the movement. I mean, we know a few years back when Bernie was supporting efforts to try to unionize Amazon and fighting for the rights of workers at Disney. Both of those corporations preemptively came out with higher wages. I think Walmart did the exact same thing. Now that doesn't mean that you shouldn't still unionize, because there's the public health crisis that we're still in the middle of is a reminder that pay isn't the only thing that your corporation needs to have your interests in. But it shows that having this movement and having it be supported by at least some national politicians and having them sort of start to rack up wins has benefits outside of just those workers. The Starbucks activists that we had on like a week or two ago said they've been contacted by workers at a bunch of other companies who want to know more about how they can help to organize. I know Chris Smalls of the Amazon union, he says the same thing. Like they it's basically you're developing strategies and institutional memory that you can then help out other workers with. And by the way, I wanted to read just briefly, the Starbucks Workers Union had a statement about what Schultz is announcing here, saying these benefits, including ones we've demanded since the beginning of our campaign, are a response to our organizing efforts, and we should celebrate the hard work that partners who stood up to Howard Schultz's bullying put in to make this happen. Many of the proposed benefits have been proposed at the bargaining table in Buffalo, and that is great. So we are seeing more and more stores unionize like basically every week at this point. Credit to those who are doing it now. Credit especially to those who did it early on. They were up against so much, David, but it is great to see a lot of workers, whether on the union side or maybe now even on the non-union side, at least briefly, their lot in life be improved.
Yeah, and from what I understand, Schultz has a history of this kind of union busting. So, I mean, he's been doing this his entire career. So to have now this kind of come back on him, blowback, and he is running around with his head cut off trying to stop this. It is it's almost hilarious to watch, because this is really caught fire. I mean, this came out of nowhere. Even I didn't expect, Starbucks to have, what is it, like 50 stores now that have won their union vote. It's something, it's insane. So it's showing you just how needed, how desired this was. That it wasn't just, one or two places that they were claiming at the beginning, it's just a couple stores that are unhappy. No, it appears to be a lot of them. And this is going to keep happening. And to see the organizing or the communication between, them and Amazon workers as well and others, and have that this organized fight together, regardless of the workplace, is just very inspiring.
White House officials are cheering for. A number of them told me this over the weekend, that if Elon Musk indeed takes Twitter, they hope the first thing he does is put Donald Trump back on it. Because they think that if Trump starts tweeting again, it'll just simply remind these voters of the crazy that accompanied his time in office, particularly around January 6th. He'll amplify these fringe messages. He'll amplify these fringe right-wing candidates. And that can only be good for Democrats, they think.
So that is Jonathan Lemire, who is in that reporting contradicting the initial news that came out of the White House, which was that the Biden administration was saying they were a little bit worried about the people that would be potentially allowed back on a Twitter. Well, now apparently they're doing what I think most progressives could have predicted, assuming that we'll just let Trump go crazy, make him front and center, make the news about him, and that will help us, certainly. And they're not saying this out loud, it'll stop us from having to do anything. And so they say, they acknowledge that it could cut both ways. He could eat up an extraordinary amount of political oxygen, but it's also possible that he could push the big lie or feud with other Republicans or, I don't know, inspire a crowd to murder politicians in the Capitol. Do they not get that there are real world consequences to when he spreads these lies and conspiracy theories? It doesn't just stop when a person hits the retweet button. They believe that stuff. They go out there into the world. So David, I'm curious what you think about this strategy of like, just let's wait, let Trump get back on Twitter, and that'll help out a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it has a real impact, but it also, I think they're wrong to think this is going to hurt him. I mean, if anything, he's become a little less popular since being kicked off Twitter. So to bring him back on, put him in the spotlight again, they're making the wrong assumption. I think that they think they won 2020 simply because of Trump. I think largely it was because of COVID. I think people wanted, saw, you know, the disaster that COVID was and thought that Biden would be able to better handle it. Now the jury's maybe a little out on that, but he's at least, you know, understands science and isn't full of crap on that issue. But to think that simply sunlight is, you know, the best disinfectant here and it's going to somehow destroy Trump, I think is just wrong. They have to have an actual message. They have to actually, forget the message. They have to deliver now while they're in power. They have to do something. If they don't do that, then they are really setting themselves up for a disaster.
Exactly. Yeah, they need to remember at some point that they're not just campaigning to get into power. They're already in power and they could act like it every once in a while. Yeah, I don't know exactly. Like if all we cared about was the campaign implications of him coming on, which I think is a crazy way to think about the world. But even if we were to do that, I don't know. I mean, his approval rating did go down while he was president, as he was front and center in the news a lot. Was that just because of his social media activity though? I mean, it might well have been the policies that he enacted and all that, and certainly COVID didn't help him. So I think it's an incredibly risky strategy. By the way, Trump says he's not gonna do it. Even if Elon Musk does take over, he says, I'm not going on Twitter. I am going to stay on Truth. I hope Elon buys Twitter because he'll make improvements to it and he's a good man. But I am gonna be staying on Truth. He's barely on Truth anyway. And he's a massive liar.
Right? Trust Central. That's what it is.
Trust Central. Yeah, I don't trust him.
He forgot the name of his own platform. That's like
exactly. In his defense, he hasn't been on it in a long time. Sometimes when I take a long period off of playing a video game, I can't remember all the buttons. That's basically what happened to him with social media. But I don't even trust Elon Musk here. Like in a lot of his statements, since he supposedly is starting the process of buying it, there's been a lot of hedging. I'm not even like, I think that there's a good chance that he ends up buying it in the end, but I don't think that it's guaranteed at this point. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there was a Reuters piece that came out saying all the reasons why he may not. I mean, the Tesla valuation has gone down considerably, and that was supposed to be part of how he was going to be able to, you know, afford to do this. So, you know, as you said, I think the jury's out on whether or not it actually goes through. I do think it seems likely that it will, but there is a little doubt there in terms of if whether or not he will end up buying it. But ultimately, Trump's going to be back on Twitter. I mean, he cares about the audience. Sure. So if Elon Musk buys it and Trump's reinstated, he'll of course be back. That's where the audience is. So yeah, there's no doubt about that in my mind.
I think there's a good chance. By the way, I checked it. The Tesla stock has recovered a little bit since that big dip, but it is still below where it was at just a couple of weeks ago, let alone like more than a year. Anyway, if you're on our linear platforms or on the podcast, thank you so much for listening. If you're on Twitch or YouTube or the members app though, we've got a lot more to talk about. David and I'll be back, so don't go anywhere. I had to read this. I saw a Twitch comment from Franklin Sharpslicer who sent in one of his bits of poetry saying, Black Pearl Dragon never gives up a fight. It was just a battle, but I say she's right. The Uruk-hai shine the mark of the shadow. She's the knight of light, knowing that she will conquer using the sword of light. So I bandage a wound, stitch a slice. It ain't always pretty, but you know that's life. We're the dragon squad, that's just what we do. Swords into the darkness as the watch pursue. I like that. That's pretty damn good. That would have taken me 2 hours to write if I could have done it at all. So thank you, Franklin. Diana sent in a super chat to say, Happy May the 4th. Let's take inspiration from the Rebel Fleet. Yeah, exactly. Like, look, this is a fight. Nobody ever said it was going to be easy. I would argue we've said the exact opposite for years. But we're all that we have. And I know how badly the other side would love for us to quit. That's why they lure people away from the movement with money. Well, we have no plans to quit. We have no plans to just give up the US government, our society, our culture to these lunatics. As Early Bird sent it to Super Chat, say, May the 4th be with you as the Trumpire strikes back against women's rights. The fight continues, Rebel Dragons. Thanks TYT for giving us the truth and a strong supportive community. Thank you for giving us a strong supportive community. I can't do that. I can wish for it. You all are the people who have to provide that, and you do, thankfully. Birdie the Kiwi Dragon sent it to Super Chat to say, the force is strong with Nina. The corporates don't like seeing retention of this kind of fire. Keep moving forward, never stop. Scare the living daylights out of the corporate Democrats. I hope so. Angie says, I had an abortion in Florida years ago. I was still in active addiction and I know I made the right decision. These psychos would have preferred me to have a child born addicted to heroin, evil AF. Yeah, they don't care about the individual stories, the individual experiences, what people actually go through. It is horrendous. But thank you for sharing your story. We do appreciate that. Crystal Tone has been a tier 2 member for 12 months, says, keep up the fight, dragons unite. I have friends in red states now working to get more of their friends out to vote to make big changes. We can make our voices heard everywhere. We have to.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.